Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. It's been a disorienting 48 hours for me. I was on a flight next to a compulsive eater. Michigan lost to Michigan State in heartbreaking and very demoralizing fashion. And now Joel Embiid is one of the richest NBA players there is, despite only playing 31 games. I can't get my balance. I'm like shaky. I'm like a Jenga stack right now.
You're all over the place. I love it. Yeah, I hit you up at about 5:15 to try and record this podcast early, and you were on one of your nature walks. And luckily, we waited because around 5:30, Adrian Wojnarowski broke the news that Joel Embiid has signed his deal, which, I mean, I expected him to sign an extension, but I don't think anyone expected a $150 million deal from Embiid. Where are you at as you try to process all this?
So I look at this contract, and what do they always say? It's like, you know, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. Mm-hmm. This deal, to me, it really leans hard towards hope for the best and not really taking into account what could be the worst case scenario here. So I hate to always compare Embiid to Oden, but I think it's an important thing to do. Let's just say Greg Oden had signed a five-year extension, you know, kind of towards the end of his rookie deal, right? That contract would have covered like the four full seasons that he didn't play, his comeback in Miami, his trip abroad. I think he played in China, and it basically wouldn't have ended until something like 6 years after he had played his last meaningful NBA game, right? Like it would have gone way past the point of him being a productive player. And so when you use that as like a worst case scenario benchmark, you realize if something happens to Embiid this season, God forbid, nobody is hoping for that. But if something were to happen this season, yes, there are protections built into this contract. So it's not like this typical full max deal, but there is a significant salary cap hit extending well into the future. And I think if they didn't have any other talent on this roster, you'd be okay with taking on some of that risk. But you're going to have guys like Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz in a best case scenario, guys potentially being, you know, franchise level players who you're really going to want to build around and who could actually be magnets to try to attract other talent. Now you just have this big chunk of your salary cap space in a worst case scenario tied up on a guy who can't play at all. I think that's really rough. I think if I was in their situation, I would have made Embiid play it out this year, period. You know, this wasn't enough of a give back from him to make this worthwhile. And I think that there's just too much injury risk and exposure to that risk in this situation. I would have maybe even, you know, told his agent, look, if he makes it through 65 games, he can have that max. It'll be waiting for him next summer. You know, try to make sure that Embiid, you know, feels like he's a part of the team. But the major reason why you do these deals early is to, you know, there's two. One, you're trying to get, you know, a huge discount. I don't think they really got that here. Two, you're trying to put the player's mind at ease. You're saying, hey, don't worry about the money. Focus on basketball. Newsflash, Joel Embiid should not be worried about the money. He should be worried about playing 35 or 40 or 50 games here next season for the first time in his entire career. So to me, it just fails both of those tests. And for that reason, I don't like it. I don't hate it because obviously you're locking up a player who you want to have and who is sort of your identity. But I wouldn't have done it.
That's really interesting. Not terribly surprising. I figured you would come out on the glass half empty side of this. I don't know. I've crossed over. Like, I've gone too far into Sixers world. I spent the afternoon working on a feature that's going to run later this week about the Sixers after being at Media Day and talking to Brett Brown last week. And I also listened to a live podcast with TJ McConnell yesterday from Spike and Mike and the rights to Ricky Sanchez. So it's hard for me to look at this rationally, but I will say there are a couple differences from Oden. First of all, like I thought Joel Embiid was going to be another Oden and it was going to be really depressing and they were going to spend 4 years spinning their wheels and it was just never really going to work. The one thing you have to give Embiid is that even when he's been injured, he's like a gregarious personality who makes a difference to that franchise. Like, he's a great franchise player, whereas Odin sort of wilted immediately.
Chuckles don't win playoff games, Andrew.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that they do. As far as the contract, your point is dead on. Like, I guess the reason you would give him this money up front is that you can at least get some clauses in there that protect you against injuries, whereas I guess the Sixers were thinking if he hits the open market next summer, he'll be free to sign a deal that they can then match. But still, a team like the Nets did this year with Otto Porter, a team will just give him $150 million without any incentives in there related to health and
but
force
a team
the
is
Sixers
only,
to match.
But don't you think a team is only going to do that if he proves he consistently stay healthy?
Yeah.
This year, and if that's the case, then you're willing to pay him a four-year max player. When he's healthy, he's a max guy. Nobody's debating that. He just hasn't been healthy, and I think, to me, that would have been preferable, especially because it would be a four-year deal. So four-year max, boom, no. Who cares? If he earns it, give it to him. You just match and move on.
100%. I'm with you, and I'm skeptical that there would have been a team out there willing to risk tying up $150 million of their cap in Joel Embiid, because I still don't think he's going to play more than 50 or 60 games this year. But the flip side of that is he's better than Odin was, and he's better than almost any big man in the NBA right now. And I think that is something to consider here. Like, I understand he's only played 31 games, and there have been all sorts of people on Twitter already talking shit about this deal. But, like, the dude is a freak, and I was actually thinking about this at the end of the last podcast, where I mentioned that unicorns haven't really translated to winning in the NBA thus far. And there are a lot of reasons for that, whether it's Towns, Porzingis, like a lot of Anthony Davis. Half the reason is that Towns and Anthony Davis are in the West. But Embiid is actually the exception, where when he was healthy, he kind of lifted the Sixers by himself and made everybody was more confident with him on the floor. The offense was a lot better, and the defense was excellent. So that's a guy who's worth the money, and I'm coming at this
Andrew,
from the Wizards side, where, like, I remember when the Wizards gave Bradley Beal $130 million, and you can go back and listen to the podcasts. Like, I was horrified at the time, but the reason they did it is because if Beal isn't a max guy, then there's no plan at all, and you might as well just reset. And I think the same thing is true with Embiid, where, like, if Embiid's not going to work out in Philly, then there's not enough there to justify trying to win with this iteration of the roster. So it's there's less risk than you think is all I would say.
Anthony Davis has made the playoffs and gone toe-to-toe with the Warriors, nearly won a playoff game against Golden State.
How many games did the Pelicans win last year?
Joel Embiid has won an average of 3.3 games per year during his NBA career. He's appeared in 13 wins, and you're trying to tell me this is the poster child for winning unicorns? Get out of here, man. Look, I kind of hear what you're saying.
He really does make a difference.
Of course he does. He's awesome. He's worth the max. We've said that. Everybody agrees with that. But this if healthy thing isn't something you just, like, slide into the end of your report from Philadelphia Media Day, which I'm trying to say, hey, that's cool that he's a nice guy. He's friendly. Is he even going to play? Has he been cleared? And I guess he finally did get cleared for, you know, some level of 5-on-5, you know, since Media Day. But
yeah, well, that's the other
I just don't see it, man.
Maybe he was sitting out because of the ongoing contract talks. I think that would be my conclusion after watching the last month play out, which was reported initially in Philly, and then, like, there are a lot of denials from, like, everyone else involved in the process, but that was the rumor, and now it looks like that was true.
So, I mean, is he going to be, you know, sitting in ice packs and bubble wrap for all 5 years of this extension, or when are we going to put him out there and let him play 30 minutes in back-to-backs? I mean, like, at some point it's time to do it, you know? I don't really get your argument here at all. I mean, it seems like this is significant risk. It could have been worse if you had to give him the four years full max if he had earned it next summer. That is going to be more total money. But it would arguably be less risk at that point because you would have seen him play out this season. How confident are you that he's going to make it through this season healthy?
Not super confident. I mean, it depends.
So then
on
how are you defending this deal?
I'm defending the deal by saying that, look, if you're the Sixers, if Embiid's not the plan, there is no plan. Like, he very much is.
I'm saying that was true before they got Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz. If Simmons is healthy, has a good season, Markelle Fultz looks like he hits the ground as a rookie, there is an alternate plan here. That's two pretty awesome guys who people might want to play around.
They gave $23 million to J.J. Redick this summer. You don't do that. And the reason that that deal made sense is because, like, there's nothing else to spend the money on. There's not going to be people who are going to want to come to Philadelphia if Embiid isn't healthy.
That's true when these guys are 18, 19 years old and they're still getting their NBA sea legs. Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz together could be really, really good. And it might not take their full rookie deals to get there. They could be impact players, big time guys who are impacting winning like you're claiming Joel Embiid does by their third years. I think that's reasonable. And then at that point, if Embiid in a worst case scenario is just dead salary, that is going to significantly crimp your plans. You would rather have flexibility in that scenario, building around those two building blocks. No, they're not going to be competing for, you know, the LeBron Jameses, the Kawhi Leonards, or whoever's going to be free agents at that point. I agree with that, but they're going to be able to compete a lot better for free agents than they did this past summer when, you know, as you pointed out, it was a struggle even to get a guy like J.J. Redick there. I don't think that this is still a franchise that's only Embiid or bust. I think that's selling guys like Fultz and Simmons too short. That's my point.
Yeah, and that's fair. I just don't know. I think the jury is still out on Fultz and Simmons, and they are also locked in. I mean, Simmons, I think, has another 2 years on his rookie deal, or maybe three. Fultz has 4 years on his rookie deal. Like, that, it's only going to get tight at the very end for them. And I also think it's a little tough because we're recording this at 6:15 on Monday night. And so the details of the protections are not really out yet. And they probably will be by the time this runs tomorrow morning. But I think that they're probably protected more than we realize on that back end, which is, you're right to worry about this. Like, you're right to be skeptical of all of this. All I'm saying is that after interacting with Embiid a handful of times over the last few years, like, I find it hard to be a cynical asshole about this. And I'm just happy for him that he got paid. And I think that it's not as crazy as it seems if you're the Sixers.
Okay, guys. So Andrew scored on him once at All-Star Weekend in an exhibition game. And now all of a sudden he wants to hand out $150 million. Well, I'm glad that we're seeing this so, like, you know, impartially and unbiasedly. Unbelievable.
I don't know who else. I'm just kidding, dude.
Don't worry about it.
Who else are they going to spend the money on? It's like,
I don't like that. Look, I don't like that argument. I really don't. Because I think this is a team that for the last 2 years has been Embiid and nothing else.
Ben Simmons is going to make an All-NBA team.
Probably not on his rookie deal, but I think not too long after that. And I think when you have two young guys like that, you could, if Embiid had just never happened, like, let's just pretend the whole thing was just, you know, gone. Like, and I go back to the Oden example, like, retooling after Oden actually didn't take Portland that long because they were able to pair, you know, two guys in Aldridge, who was closer to his prime, and Lillard, who came in a little bit older than most rookies, and they were able to kind of go a different direction fairly quickly, find some role guys, whether it's Wesley Matthews, Batum, whoever else, and now you've got a squad, right? And I think I could see a situation where Philly is able to kind of move past Embiid thanks to having these two guys in place, right? And that's one reason why I like the Fultz deal for them, because I thought it worked with or without Embiid when they were making that trade, right? Like, if you have two dynamic ball handlers, that's a really good place to start your franchise.
I just think you need to be realistic about how quickly those guys are going to get rolling. Like, I think Fultz is probably going to take a year or two before he turns into even half of the player he's going to be. And Simmons, I mean, the best case scenario for Simmons is that he's sort of like a poor man's Giannis, or even just a regular Giannis. And Giannis took a couple years before he was able to really, like, power the Bucks and carry them a little bit. And So like that, that wasn't until year four with Giannis.
No, I feel
Simmons
you,
has
but
yet
you're,
to play
you're
a basketball game.
But you're trying to have it both ways because you're always telling me Giannis is going to leave Milwaukee because they don't have the right kind of help for him. Well, guess what? You want to have flexibility if you want to find help. A guy like Embiid could stand in the way of your flexibility if he's not able to play consistently and prevent your ability from building around Ben Simmons once he's ready for you to truly build around him. That's all I'm saying. That's a real risk here. And I don't think it's fair to view Philly as Embiid is the whole franchise. I think they have moved out of that era. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Well, then maybe a smarter way to sell this for Philly and for me, a believer in this deal, is to say that at least under this plan, you're able to mitigate some of the risk. Whereas I think if they think going into next summer that he was going to get $130, $140 million from some team that was just trying to screw with them, they would not have been covered against any of that risk. And so this allows them to lock them up, to lock Embiid up and cover themselves a little bit. So to me, that's a smart play. And
they've got a new social media manager locked in. You know, they got funny tweets until 2023. So congratulations.
I appreciate it. We needed someone to balance this out, but I do think it's not stupid for the Sixers.
No, it's not stupid. Look, to be clear, I want to make this crystal clear. I don't hate it for them. I just personally wouldn't have done it. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
And I don't love it for them, and I don't love it because Embiid is funny or zany or whatever. That's not true. I hate his Twitter account is not cool. I don't like his Twitter account. I like him. And I think as a player, he's so dominant that he elevates the entire foundation for them. The baseline is a lot higher with him in the mix. And you bet on a guy like that. So
I think one of his biggest assets as a player is that he likes Rihanna over Beyonce. I mean, to me, that is
great.
One of the things I get most excited about when I think about Embiid.
All right. Well, let's move on. Congrats to Joel Embiid. We had one mailbag question that you wanted to get to before we get to top five, bottom three. This is from Drew. He says, I'm a new listener, but I just got into your podcast during a long ass road trip and now I'm hooked. My question for you guys is this. Are NBA preseason games actually telling or worthwhile in any way? And I'm curious, what do you think on that one?
Well, let me say, you know, back in the day before I became this establishment NBA media member who can snap his fingers and put Lonzo Ball on the Lakers or snap his fingers and have them redo the All-Star game, you know, to my personal request, I was part of, the resistance. And I got into a lot of trouble locally in Portland against sort of the powers that be because I was demanding that they televise every preseason game because I thought it was that important that we watch it. And the team and the local media partner and basically everybody else really pushed back on that hard because obviously they didn't want to spend the money to televise it when like 14 people would watch it. So yes. I will say that I am coming from a very reactionary perspective on this. Way far alt left, I guess is probably the way to say it. past the Bernie Sanders wing. I really enjoy preseason basketball. I think part of it is just because usually it's been a couple months since I've been able to see competitive play. I like to see how new guys are fitting in. I like to see the chemistry aspects. And sometimes I like to see who tries and who doesn't. And also I like to see who's out of shape. That's always been fun for me. And maybe who's lost a step to the point where they just can't keep up. So for all those reasons, I think it's meaningful. But I also think, obviously, for some teams, the Spurs not really playing Kawhi, you know, LeBron milking this ankle thing for basically the entire preseason. And there's a lot of teams out there who are not treating it the same way. I think it matters clearly in different amounts to each team.
Yeah, and context is pretty big with the preseason. I just want to say we need more tales from early years Golliver when it was just you and the Blazers
raging against the machine.
A lot of heart. Yeah, like that. I want to hear about like 23-year-old Ben in Portland writing angry emails to Neil O'Shea. The my answer on this one is I really, first of all, I can't find preseason basketball on television. Is it on League Pass? Is that how people are watching it?
Yeah, there's League Pass. The Lakers here locally in LA get their games broadcast because everybody's insane. Lonzo's not even playing, and they're basically just televising everybody sad that Lonzo's not playing for 3 hours straight. Phenomenal TV. Well,
I went to Wizards-Knicks preseason game on Friday night, and it was pretty lifeless. It was hard to enjoy. I was really excited to be walking around the concourse, back with all my old buddies, but once the game started, it was hard to follow along and not get depressed.
Okay. I got a question for you, though, because I read an excellent interview with you on truthaboutit.net. And on that interview, you were fronting pretty hard about how excited you were to be at a preseason game. But now you're going to come on the podcast and say you didn't enjoy it. So pick a side.
I was excited to be at the game, but that interview was published before, or we recorded the interview before tip-off. What I'm telling you is that I was really excited until tip-off, and then I was like, oh, man, like everyone is just really half-assing it tonight. I don't think Porzingis even started. It was bleak. And the real reason I don't watch preseason is in the past, I've watched some of these games and like jumped to conclusions. I think like an example last year would be that I watched Chris Dunn and the Timberwolves. And I was already in pretty deep with the Wolves at that point. But Chris Dunn looked great. And I started talking. I think I came on this podcast and was like, look, Chris Dunn looks like a future all-star. Like, the Wolves are going to be in great shape, like definitely winning 50, probably 55. And so that's the shit that I'm trying to avoid by not watching preseason basketball, is because it's just too easy to read way too much into games where nobody really cares.
Yeah, no, the overreaction thing is a real thing. So while you were discussing that, I happened to Google Rage Against the Machine Golliver from 2010. This is a real story that I wrote. You're going to die laughing. So Jeff Pendergraf, he used to be Jeff Pendergraf, then he changed his name to Jeff Ayers. He suffered an ACL during a preseason game that was not televised. And my headline was, no preseason television coverage adds insult to Pendergraf's injury. And then I wrote, Jeff Pendergraf might as well have torn his ACL in a black hole. And I was just kind of railing against the fact that this fan favorite has his season lost and the fans couldn't even salute him on his way off the court. And I was dead serious. So there you go. I mean, that's how delusional I get when it comes to preseason. But,
well,
yeah, I mean,
look, Don't bury your greatest hit there. Is the case for Kevin is how Ben Golliver got his start. Longtime listeners might be familiar with it. But how Ben began in basketball media is a blog spot where he wrote like a 15-page manifesto. I know it's 15 pages because I printed it out and I have the hard copy. Demanding that the Blazers take Kevin Durant over Greg Oden. And I've honestly never read it. I'm saving it for a special occasion. At some point, we're going to do a pod where I just read that aloud to the people. And it'll probably be, you can go on vacation and that'll be how I hold down the podcast, is I'll read the case for Kevin.
Yeah, what's amazing is you promised to me that you'd read it once the Warriors won the title and Kevin finally had a ring, but then you backtracked on that. You didn't want to validate the results of the election. You know, you were just like, no, I'm not even gonna give him credit for it. So you have it ready.
I'm not lying. I really am saving it for a special occasion. It's gonna be great.
To bring us back to the topic here, real quick though, I did see the Blazers Clippers play preseason on Sunday, and. I don't want to overreact because what you're saying about not overreacting is totally true. The Blazers looked pretty darn good. They were getting points the way you would expect. Lillard was, 35 in limited minutes. I mean, he was really gunning. CJ McCollum was doing his thing. Nurkic is shooting the ball better from the mid-range and stepping out a little bit to three-point range, you know, kind of flirting with Unicorn. I think he's kind of slowly growing that horn through his forehead, just slightly trying to get himself into that uniform conversation. So I think, from that standpoint, It made me more confident that Portland was going to be a playoff team. And the Clippers, I've been going back and forth on because they have looked great at times during the preseason. This game, they didn't look so great. Okay, it's a 12:30 tip start on a Sunday, so we can kind of forgive the Clippers. That's never really been their strong suit.
Yes.
But there was some pretty serious concerns. Like Gallo didn't play. Their wing rotation without Gallo, and they also didn't have Austin Rivers, so they couldn't kind of go to the three-guard lineup. It was rough, really rocky. I mean, the drop-off there behind like Gallo and Austin Rivers is steep, and it has me kind of concerned on their behalf. So I think it's going to be a real, a real sailing race, like tacking left, tacking right, if you're the Clippers, to just kind of really stretch the boat metaphor from their nickname.
No kidding. You're doing great.
I think it's going to be a rough. I think it's just going to be a very inconsistent up and down type season for them.
How did Teodosic look?
So he sprained his finger, but then played through it in a preseason game. So he's got the he probably went to the back of the the locker room, smoked a cigarette, got himself right, and came back out. Pretty remarkable gutsy performance. He was inconsistent. I mean, he's fun. He didn't have any of the crazy highlight assists. And he was struggling, with Lillard and Portland's guards for sure on the other end. But no, he's a phenomenon. I wouldn't say he's like, Lonzo in terms of like getting the buzz going, but he definitely generates some buzz when he's on the court.
So for today's podcast, we were supposed to pick our top five teams to love and watch, and then three teams to ignore. So I really struggled with the Clippers because the idea of the Clippers and if they're all healthy, I think will be a lot of fun. And it could just get really depressing though. And like my brain is telling me the Clippers are going to finish in 11th place and it's going to be dark.
Whoa. I thought I was down on them and I had them 9th and I wanted to revise that and kind of kick them up to 8th over Denver. You really think they're going to be 11th?
I just think guys are going to get hurt and they're going to be screwed because, I mean, you didn't even talk about Blake's injury issues. Gallo, historically speaking, you can count on Gallo to miss 20 games. And if you remove either one of those guys from the equation, this team really does not have a whole lot to enjoy. With all due respect to Teodosic, who's awesome. Patrick Beverley is great too. But like Patrick Beverley's going to score 12 points a game. And that's it. And defensively, like he can only do so much. Like we said last week, everybody scores at this point, especially in the West. So I don't know, man. I just think that like health wise, there are too many red flags to believe in this team, and that's why I didn't end up putting them on my list because I think there's just going to be a month or two in the middle of the season where things get really dark. And I think big picture, I'm skeptical because they sort of try to have it both ways this summer where like they were smart enough to realize that we shouldn't pay Chris Paul $200 million, but then they like 4 days later paid Blake Griffin $175 million, and it just seems like that's the sort of like they didn't really choose a path on that one, and usually that gets teams punished, and I think that's what we'll see in LA this year.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't give them credit for not paying Chris. I think Chris made that call and he just kind of hit the eject button. Like he didn't even want to take their money. And I think from that standpoint, they backed into the smart situation.
Chris made that call in part because he had not gotten a max deal from them yet. And the offer, like it's hard to know exactly how it played out, but it certainly sounded like at the time they were sort of hemming and hawing on whether or not they should pay him. And eventually Chris just got sick of waiting and was just like, I'm signing with Houston.
Yeah, but it didn't take him too long because remember that deal happened before July 1st. So he like whatever hesitation they had on their end is fine. I think he was already sort of looking elsewhere and having, different plans for himself and mine. And it's weird that they hesitated because they have been so synonymous with Chris. Like he's been sort of their franchise guy. But I hear what you're saying in terms of like, where's the consistency factor? I think keeping Blake ensures them a certain level of relevance. The other thing I'd say too is we should keep an eye on DeAndre because there's been some, kind of extension talk here, but are they really willing to do that beforehand? Are they going to let him go into an expiring contract season? I think that will also say something about their direction.
And look, the other thing I'd say Blake is more fun without DeAndre involved. Blake and DeAndre have been a kind of an awkward front court mix forever. And like, granted, DeAndre does a lot of things that Blake can't do, whether it's like protecting the rim. He rebounds more than Blake does at this point. But offensively, there's always been a weird spacing with those two.
Yeah, because, I mean, they're basically traditional because Blake's not really a three-point shooter, and there aren't tons of teams that stay big as much as they do when they play those guys together. The one thing I'd say from the preseason takeaway, though, is I thought DeAndre was going to look a lot more useless without Chris. I think I was giving Chris a lot of credit for making DeAndre as an offensive player, and they have been able to get pretty consistent offense from DeAndre when they've been playing well, with Beverly and Teodosic kind of playing that setup role, so that kind of bodes well for them. But the same fit questions that you're talking about are going to persist. If they pay him, then they're committing to that. You know, if they don't, then he potentially becomes a trade piece if things don't go right, you know, during the regular season, which could kind of make things interesting. I think the other big reason to look at LA, they've kind of been distancing themselves from Doc, haven't they? I mean, stripping him from the front office stuff that he had, bringing in Jerry West, not committing quickly to Chris, you know. So
that's another reason.
If you're a coach,
yeah,
if you'd prefer to have Chris, you know,
they're half-assing it. This was the perfect summer to move on from Doc Rivers, and they sort of did by stripping him of all his titles, and then they didn't actually fire him, and he's back again coaching Austin Rivers with that weird ass relationship. And I don't think Blake and DeAndre are that fond of Doc at this point, and so that's all of those are factors that could weigh toward them sort of spiraling at some point this year.
Well, now that we've talked about why they're not one of your top five teams to watch, let's talk about your top five teams to watch.
All right, good. Number one, I've got the Denver Nuggets. Their over-under is 45.5. And this team, so you just said you bumped them from the playoffs?
I did. I think I've got some questions there. I mean, having just no answer at point guard scares me. And so ultimately, that's why I'm kind of willing to knock them down to ninth, which is where they were last year. But I do think they're going to far outperform from an entertainment value standpoint than their record.
The point guard thing is really scary. It's hard to believe in the Nuggets knowing that they're currently debating between Emmanuel Mudiay and Jameer Nelson. And earlier today, I saw people putting Eric Bledsoe on the Nuggets with a midseason trade. And there are certain things that make you take stock of your life and how you're living it. And that happened to me with the Eric Bledsoe rumor, because I swear to God, for at least the last 4 years, at the start of every season, I've been dreaming of getting Bledsoe on the Bucks or the Nuggets. And here we are again. The Nuggets still have the pieces to make the deal work. He would still be an amazing fit. And we'll see. That could be the solution there. But you're right to be concerned. Everybody should be concerned by Jameer Nelson and Emmanuel Mudiay as like the guys in Denver. Because Jamal Murray is more of a two guard and isn't really ready to play that role. And I know a lot of Nuggets fans and even some national people say like it point guard doesn't really matter with Nikola Jokic as like the quarterback of that team, but I don't know, it just is shaky. That said, the Nuggets have so many guys that I really truly enjoy. Like Jokic is just so awesome, in part because he's so round and unathletic and still finds a way to make defenses look ridiculous. And then beyond that, like they've got Wilson Chandler, they've got Gary Harris, who's great off the ball and is fun. And we talked about how he's the probably the number one fantasy prospect coming into the NBA season this year. and he just got paid. But Will Barton, Wilson Chandler, Paul Millsap is one of those guys who on most teams I would not enjoy, but I recognize that the Nuggets need some balance. It's just like how I need you on this podcast. Like without Paul Millsap, they would be completely screwed. But with him, providing some defensive discipline, and he could still stretch the floor. Like they are in good shape, but I worry about them at the same time because they've committed a lot of money to this particular roster and they're kind of locked in. So if it doesn't work, it could get dark.
Yeah, you were mentioning, I think you said quarterback there when you were talking about the front court guys, and I all of a sudden had these horrible flashbacks to Saturday night, because Michigan football, for people who don't follow it, basically has a dream defense. I mean, they've been at or near the top defensively all season long, and the problem for the last couple of years has been just abysmal quarterback play, and it's like, how far can you go as an organization if your quarterback just sucks? And in college football, we're finding out not nearly as far as you would hope. And I think that's what we may find out here with Denver too, because every night in the West, they go against basically awesome point guards, at least from the playoff teams. They also don't have a three who really can do that type of stuff either, right? Like, they can't even like ask a guy like, say, Hayward in Utah last year, or even Gallo for them last year. I think them losing Gallo was kind of an overlooked loss because of the Millsap addition. Like, Millsap was the biggest guy they'd signed in free agency in like 5 or 6 years, so that got more attention than, you know, Gallo leaving. And so I think that winds up being more of a sidestep than you would think. And then they just, like, Harris is not a primary playmaking type creator on the wing either. So it's like they kind of have a real dearth of that from 1 through 3, which puts all the pressure in the world on Jokic. And there's a limit, I think, to how many minutes he can play. And then there's a limit to how good your defense can be if he's playing huge minutes for you. So I think they're going to be really entertaining. And I think we should probably try to focus this conversation on why they're entertaining.
Because, why they're great. I know. Yeah. I just needed to vent on some of my Nuggets worries. They're on the list because they're going to be fascinating to watch all year long. And it's some of the twists and turns. Like, we're going to find out whether Juancho Hernangómez can actually play the three. We're going to find out whether Jamal Murray is as good as the Nuggets seem to think he is. Like, they were taking Jamal Murray off the table in any Kyrie talks. And it's going to be really interesting to see what this team can actually be. And
either way, we're going to find out. I don't think we're going to find out on Murray, though. Yeah, I don't think we're going to find out yet on Murray. And that's the thing, is if I knew we were going to get an answer on him or at point guard, I would have less concerns and I'd be more all in. Right now, I'm kind of hesitant. Just for context, though, I did my entertainment value rankings 1 through 30. I look at projected success, style of play, firepower, star power, age, health, coaching, personality. I had Denver at 9. So it's not like I'm out on them. You know, I think they're going to be a top 10 team in terms of entertainment value. I just am concerned that they're going to hold up quite as well as some of these other Western Conference playoff teams.
Yeah, the way I would sell them is to say, if you're dumb and just want to watch scoring, the Nuggets are awesome. And if you're interested in team building and all sorts of like nerdy NBA shit, the Nuggets present a lot of interesting questions. So I'm in. Who's your number one?
So I actually have really boring answers for this, so I think we should keep going with your list, because I'm just favoring really good teams. I mean, that's kind of how I look at it. I find that the most successful teams are the most interesting almost always. So I guess if I had to gun to my head, I would say Golden State's going to be the most entertaining team. Two, I would go with Houston. And I think maybe I can just quickly talk about why I think Houston. You'll probably poke some holes in it. But I think that the storyline around them has focused far too much on Harden versus Chris Paul, rather than Chris Paul sort of being kind of indoctrinated into this entire fraternal culture. Like, he's the new pledge. They already have the whole fraternity set up. Like, D'Antoni's got this whole thing set up. They've got all these other role players. This is not your classic, like, star versus star, who's gonna sacrifice type of situation. It's more like they're sort of bringing in a new member into how they do things. Chris is very high IQ. D'Antoni, obviously, from an offensive standpoint, very high IQ. Harden, I think, underrated IQ. And everybody else fits. So I think it's actually going to be a fairly smooth transition for him. He's not going to have to do that much. And when I watch them during the preseason, it's not just about how many three-pointers they're generating, which is an obscene number. I mean, some of these games are putting up 43s or more.
Yeah.
It's about the quality of those threes. These guys, having two elite playmakers in Harden and Chris Paul, is generating really clean looks. And so from an entertainment value standpoint, I mean, these guys can put 20 points up in 2.5 minutes, you know? I mean, 3-3-3-3, bang, bang, bang. I mean, and they just never really stop. And so from that standpoint, they play so smart. Offensively, they're very disciplined. I love that. They stick to their principles. And I think there's less nonsense. I mean, you know, they're not chasing the BS foul calls on the three-pointers as much as they have in the past. I think there's a little bit less flopping and just more kind of pure basketball.
You don't find it boring at all, though? Because I feel like they've hacked basketball to an extent that isn't fun. Like it kind of feels like watching TCU or Baylor in the Big 12. And I've made this comparison in the past, but it's just like eventually when you're scoring like 77 points in a football game, it all kind of blurs together. And that's why I can't get into the Rockets. I think they're going to win 55 or 60 games and they're going to be fun nominally fun, but it's like too much. It's like a sugar high or something.
No, I hear you. I mean, you get numb to it, but you know what's boring is watching the Kings score 70 for a full game, you know, like during the preseason. I mean, that's boring.
I'm not here to rip for the Kings.
Now we're saying, oh, like, can Scal hit a turnaround fadeaway over two defenders from 10 feet? That's boring. If I want to watch something that's boring, I'll watch dumb basketball that should have been phased out 15 years ago. I find cutting edge offensive strategy to be fascinating. And yes, I mean, a lot of times you're turning these games off in the third quarter because they're over. I mean, you could say the same thing about Golden State.
And it's also, you alluded to it, it's a combination. For me, it's a combination of like, okay, I get it. You guys are going to shoot 53s and this is getting kind of old. But then also when you pile on Harden's free throw antics, and now we're going to have Chris Paul working the refs all game. If they can get away from that, I'll maybe be ready to buy into your Rockets theory. But otherwise, like most Rocket games are just too much. And they also have some of the biggest homers in the NBA announcing their games.
So actually, if you look at your remote, there's this button called mute, and you just push it.
Look, you are definitely the guy who watches every basketball game on mute, and I respect it, and I love you for it.
Yeah, and look, no shots at anyone else, but stuff like court design, announcing crews, stadium, any of that stuff, I don't care about. I'm watching hoop. I'm not trying to watch a pageant or, you know, a beauty show or any of that stuff. Jersey design, none of that stuff factors in for me when we're talking about entertainment value. I just want to see the hoop.
Okay. Well, my second team is the Boston Celtics. Their over-under is 56.5. I don't think that they're going to get there. And look, I don't like this team. I've been rooting against this team since last spring. And
no, you're a huge Celtics fan. You want Anthony Davis to go there.
Their fans are insane and pretty insufferable. Celtics fans might rank a top A insufferable NBA fans power rankings. But you can't deny that every single game is going to be pretty fascinating with Kyrie and Horford in there. Kyrie and Hayward in there. And then they also, beyond those two, just have such a weird group. Like Aaron Baines is probably going to get 30 minutes a game. Marcus Smart, every preseason comes with people from Boston predicting that this is the year Marcus Smart's going to shoot 42% from three. So I'm not going to read too much into it, but he's not fat anymore. And then we've got Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Shane Larkin. Marcus Morris, I think a couple days ago, said he was one of the three best power forwards in the NBA. It's just going to be a really weird group, and I'm like, I'll be down to watch it any night they're on.
How long do you think it took Keith to text Marcus and say, am I in your top three or am I below you? Like that, that was an immediate reaction to that. Yeah, I mean, Marcus Smart has gotten Oprah level attention for his body weight, which is impressive. But look, I think the best reason to watch Boston will be late game, because even the people in Utah who loved Hayward, you know, I mean, we've talked at length about how they kind of sent him off and it was kind of sad and they watched him grow up. Even they were frustrated by his performance in late game situations. So does Brad Stevens help that? Does he find more creative ways to get Hayward free? Is it something about Hayward where he's just not that guy in those situations? Does it become a situation where Kyrie is just like, I want to be just like IT and take every single big shot last season and I want to be the new clutch guy? Does that wind up working? Is there any balance whatsoever? Is Kyrie really that guy? I mean, we focus so much on a few of his major highlights in the finals, which all came with LeBron also on the court. does he become the situation where it's like Westbrook and he's just such a high usage late in games that it winds up kind of backfiring? I'm very interested to see how they play out those things in crunch time. Past that, also, how do they deal with injuries? I mean, they've got so many weird players, so many guys who haven't really proven it that are going to have to play rotation minutes. If any of their main guys goes down, do they completely fall off a map, or do we get some of these guys from nowhere stepping up and really make an NBA
Gershon
name for themselves?
Yabusele, man. That's Gershon's music. Him and Semi Ojeleye, Abdel Nader. I'm excited. Like, I don't think those guys are actually going to get minutes, but those are all young players who I've really liked via, like, highlights and weird buzz among the scouting community. People really like Abdel Nader, but that said, you're right. It's a complete wild card, and I mean, as a Celtics hater and Wizards fan, it would give me a lot of pleasure to watch like the rotation just crumble this year, because I think like most national people are just writing them into the conference finals, and I think it's going to get more complicated than that, but it'll be, every game will be interesting.
There's no doubt. I am actually surprised that we've made it this far yet and you haven't put the Thunder on your list. Are you coming with the Thunder next, or should I?
So the Thunder aren't on my list, and I feel like,
what?
It's time to get honest.
What?
It's time to get honest, because I knew they would be on your list, and you've backed me into a corner where I've had to become like a Thunder believer. Just because I don't think Melo sucks, and I think that Westbrook deserved MVP last year. I'm not really a Thunder believer. And Russ, like, I don't enjoy watching him every night. So it's just, I'm not going to buy in entirely. I think they're going to be fun, and there will be some novelty to watching all those three guys try to work it out. But me personally, speaking from my heart with my five teams to watch, I don't care for the Thunder on most nights.
Yeah, that is a real departure from voting for Russell Westbrook for MVP, for hyping up Carmelo Anthony for months and months, for telling me how Paul George is going to be the second coming of Kevin Durant.
I mean, not going to let you turn me into an OKC believer on this podcast.
Man, this is why I called you a grease pig a long time ago. I never know where you're going to come down on some of these things, man. Here's the stakes. You think Oklahoma City is going to be better than I do, and I think they're going to be more entertaining to watch than you do, if that makes sense. And the reason why I'm watching, it's the boom or bust potential. I'm there if it works. I'm there if it's a train wreck, and I'll rubberneck. You know what I mean? Because the stakes are very high here. Paul George's future is kind of hanging in the balance. Russell Westbrook's reputation as a player hanging in the balance. Carmelo Anthony's reputation as a player and as a winning player kind of hangs in the balance here. And then also, I think, underrated storyline, Billy Donovan's reputation as a coach is kind of hanging in the balance, because we had a pop shot from someone known as Kevin Durant. Might have been him, might have been his third alter ego, might have been his social media manager. But one way or another, it came out on his Twitter account that he wasn't really feeling Billy Donovan as a coach. That didn't get enough attention. I mean, that should have been more of the focus in the aftermath of that incident. So
I think
some pressure on Billy Donovan, too.
I think he's in a tough spot, because we've seen teams, like every team Russ has been on has had these sort of janky, disjointed offenses. And I think a lot of people just sort of pin it on Westbrook at this point, because it's happened under Scott Brooks. It happened under Billy Donovan when Durant was there, and it happened when Durant left. And so I think that's just sort of the way Westbrook is. And like, I'm not saying he's not great, but when he's your point guard, your offense is not going to have great ball movement. And that's just kind of like the only way he knows how to succeed.
I just think that there's going to be a backlash if that's how it continues, right?
So you think this is the year Donovan starts taking heat?
Oh, I think somebody's got to. And I mean, I'll be putting some of it on Westbrook's shoulders. You probably won't. You'll probably vote for him for MVP again, because you get so impressed by his fantastic fantasy stats. But
who are going to be under intense scrutiny this year are Melo, number one. He's the first scapegoat if things don't work out, because he's also, Melo definitely doesn't think of himself as the third option. He just doesn't. People need to stop saying that, like, he's going to come into this year embracing a new role. He's not wired that way. Paul George is probably not going to take heat because if they struggle, a lot of people will sympathize with George and say he just needs a better situation. But Westbrook is the number one guy who, like, if the knives will be out if they struggle early on, because I think a lot of people, like some people on this podcast, are still resentful of, like, the worship last year that trailed his every move and are ready to sort of have a little course correction this year with him.
Yeah, and let's just see what Loose Lips Paul might be able to say to people that could get him into this mix too. I mean, he's not just going to just quietly take losing if that's how it comes. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's explosive potential in lots of different directions. All three of the guys you mentioned, Donovan, are their stars. And then does anyone ever turn on the bench at any point? You know what I mean? Like, there's some really weak links there. Do the stars get frustrated in a three alphas type of way from Chicago where you know, it comes out sideways, you know, guys aren't carrying their weight. I mean, whatever it might be, if it doesn't work, I'm just saying there's a lot of different ways the blame could get kind of cast around, and it could require some, you know, very proactive moves from Presti. So I'm just excited to see them early in the season because they could be players at the trade deadline, you know, and they could be the one team where their ceiling is high enough to compete with some of these teams at the top in the West, but you know, their floor could be lower than we think too. So from all that standpoint, entertainment value wise, not knowing what to expect, being surprised on a night to night basis, that's why I've got them up there.
Good. All right. Thunder fan Ben, checking in with your some good OKC takes there. I think that they will be good in a way that is not super aesthetically pleasing. So they did not make my top five. A team that did is the Miami Heat, because I am fascinated to see how they roll out. Did you have them in your five?
No, of course not. I mean, tryhards. Come on.
Wait. Well, who's the tryhard? Me?
No, the Heat. I mean, it's like, oh, we're going to scrap it out. Oh, Dion Waiters. Oh, Goran Dragic. He bleeds, you know? Like, yeah, they're just tryhards. I mean, why are you going to say they're top five most entertaining? Give me a break.
This wasn't most entertaining. These are teams that I just enjoy on a night-to-night basis. And most entertaining, the Warriors are number one, whatever. But the Heat are basically, they can roll out like hockey shifts, first of all. They go 10 or 11 deep. Dion Waiters is a show, no matter what he's doing. If Dion Waiters is working, then it's great. And if Dion Waiters is failing or not getting the ball, he's just as entertaining. Justice Winslow, I'm fascinated by. Like, I don't know if he really has a role if he's not going to be able to shoot, or maybe that role is playing center at like 6'4.5", which would be amazing. Kelly Olynyk, I still haven't totally forgiven for the end of last season, but he's good. He's better than people realize. And then Hassan Whiteside is a fucking adventure, no matter what. Like, sometimes that guy looks like the most miserable person in the NBA, just doesn't really care about anything. And then sometimes he looks like the best center on earth. So for all those reasons, Dragic is another one who is pretty explosive. I don't know if he's going to shoot as well as he did last year. Josh Richardson, I mean, there's just like too many intriguing guys to just write this team off.
Okay, you did not convince me, but that was a really good case. I'll give you credit for that.
Winning? Where do you see them finishing in the East?
I think they'll be in the playoffs, bottom half of the playoff bracket, and you know, they'll get some buzz as potential spoilers, and then that'll be that.
They're the one team that I look at that doesn't look like a fake contender. In the East, like, you've got guys like the Bucks, basically everyone outside the Wizards, Celtics, and Cavs just looks fake to me. Like, I'm not buying what the Bucks are selling, what the Raptors are selling.
Wait, so you're saying the Heat are contenders? They're legit contenders?
No. I'm saying that they, poor choice of words, but I think that they can hang on the court with some of these teams better than the rest of the East. Like, there aren't glaring holes on that roster.
I think my next team up, you mentioned them, the Bucks. I think there's still probably some frustration about the level of help that Giannis has around him. But I would like to point to a little bit of small sample size theater here and just say that when he and Middleton were on the court last year together, they basically performed like a top five offense and they had a top five net rating when those guys were on the court, like, you know, compared to overall teams. Now, obviously, they're not going to be able to probably sustain that, you know, throughout the course of a season. But that means they have a ceiling offensively that people really aren't giving them credit for, that they've already reached and shown that they can do. Mm-hmm. I think Giannis at this point is must-see theater just kind of by himself. But with the right level of support, with another year of fine-tuning, with more dilution of the Eastern Conference, I mean, just go through the guys who are going to have to try to check Giannis on some of these Eastern Conference teams, and it's just going to be comical. I mean, he's just going to be eating night after night. And I think from that standpoint, Milwaukee's probably got a little bit more upside as a team and in the win column than people give them credit for. And the standard for them is not really that high. They've been so bad as a franchise for so long that, you know, if they could get to a situation where they're, you know, making a run at 50 wins, I think that they would have a lot of momentum build up among their local fan base. And that would sort of, you know, kind of help spur them along. I mean, yes, this is kind of like a, you know, a micro soccer team. You know, I'm talking about them almost like they're like youth sports. But
they I just have don't that see it. Look, I've loved the Bucks for years now. I've loved Giannis.
I just think you're early. You're early. But that's the thing is you're part of this, you know, this premature excitement that builds around these guys when they're 20 that should come when they're 22 or 23. So just get back on the wave. This is the year to love Giannis. This is the year to love Towns. Don't feel burned by previous years. Now they're about to do it.
You're probably right. I'm definitely the hipster who is in 2 years early and then out by the time a band is actually successful. However, there's just not that much talent in Milwaukee. I thought about them pretty hard for the top five for me, and I just know that there are a lot of nights when I'm going to tune in and be like, I don't have the energy to watch Malcolm Brogdon play 35 minutes a game. I don't have the energy to watch Chris Middleton try to create a shot for himself and end up wasting 10 seconds. Giannis is amazing. Thon McCourt, not so much. Greg Monroe, not so much. I think that they're going to end up disappointing people this year. And that bums me out, but it's also like a reality. They just haven't found ways to improve the roster. Like, Delly is probably still going to play 30 minutes a game. They brought back Jason Terry, who they actually needed last year. And it's not a good situation if you need Jason Terry at 40 years old.
They brought back their whole team because they're banking on the small sample stuff that I mentioned earlier, which is like when they do have Middleton, they're pretty darn good. I think they're going to win a playoff series. I think they're going to be really fun this year. That is something we should, you know, in 6 months look back on and see who was right, because this is a pretty clear disagreement between us.
Yeah. My final two teams, the Sixers. We could talk more Sixers later in the week, but the novelty factor, like, I'll watch any Sixers game to watch Ben Simmons out there because he is 6'10". He's legitimately playing point guard. We've been over this. And I have no idea how it's going to work. And that's before you get to Embiid. I mean, if Embiid's out there, they're legit, like, objectively a top five team entertainment wise, but we should talk about that more once I write this story. My last one though is,
this is really the cover your bases podcast though. Like, you trash guys on previous episodes, then you're gonna double background, pretend that you want to watch case they blow up. You know, you probably saw him almost get a triple double in preseason. You started to get a little nervous, could be the rookie of the year.
I listened to Brett Brown rhapsodize about Ben Simmons, and I saw David Fizdale going nuts about him. I watched some of the preseason highlights from Sixers Grizzlies where the Sixers got blown out by 20, but Simmons, I mean, he's gonna be a tough problem to solve as a point guard.
So the NBA coaches tell you these things, you listen.
No.
I'm over here lecturing you.
It.
You don't listen at all.
I'm still very skeptical of how Simmons will play out, but I'm willing to admit that there are reasons to be bullish, and it's gonna be an adventure on a nightly basis. The last one, speaking of adventures, Tom Thibodeau and the Wolves. I have no idea what to expect. Like I took them and put them in my top five and took them out three or four times over the course of this afternoon. Their over under is 47.5. They have no shooting. Andrew Wiggins is about to sign a $148 million deal and might suck. I don't know, man. I mean, where do you come down on the Wolves?
So Minnesota was number 7 on my list, kind of in a similar OKC mold of boom or bust potential. I think the single driving characteristic, though, for Minnesota is going to be Towns' development. Again, it's much like my Giannis take. People are sleeping on him. They were let down because he didn't come out of the gates like crazy last year when there was all that hype. But he did everything that people wanted. It just took him like 4 extra months to do it. You know what I
everything
mean?
So
he's coming
defense.
Back ready to roll. Yeah, no, in terms of the hype, though, like they thought he was going to be a 28-10 guy at the start of last season. And he basically was that. It just kind of started in February. You know what I mean? Defensively, I think Butler helps, but there's going to be more pressure on Towns. I think they've got some really interesting lineup questions. How much do they play big? How often do they play with two bigs? When do they decide to go smaller? The shooting thing that everybody's talking about, I definitely see as an issue. I think they've got some guys who can be better shooters than people expect. That includes all their main guys, Teague, Butler, or Wiggins. They all have the potential to be shooters if you know things are going right, but they all have the potential to be non-shooters if things aren't. This whole Wiggins contract extension is really strange. It seems like that should be done and he should want to be there. So that really makes me wonder, like, what is the holdup? Maybe we'll get an answer on that here in the next week or so. If I was me, I would not be flying to China to play preseason games without signing my extension. That sounds like a crazy risk, but what do I know?
To bring it full circle, let me ask you this. Would you rather pay $148 million to Wiggins, fully guaranteed, or have Joel Embiid get $148 million with protections against injuries?
Man, that's tough. That's really tough. I think you could flip a coin on that one. I could make strong arguments both ways. I think the conservative bond analyst who would, you know, recommend the treasury stock, you know, the treasury bonds instead of, you know, buying a stock would say Wiggins. But I think if you're trying to win a title, you'll take Embiid.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just worry that Wiggins, it's not that he's a bad player, but he really does remind me of DeRozan, and it's not a compliment. I mean, he's more athletic than DeRozan probably, but he just doesn't have a whole lot of versatility and is going to need a lot of touches to be effective. And I just know, like, last year when we were having these conversations, I was so high on the Wolves, and I'm staying loyal by keeping them here. But every time I watched a Wolves game last year, I wound up getting pissed off at Andrew Wiggins. And I'm not super enthusiastic about Jeff Teague. Taj Gibson is apparently shooting threes. Like, every power forward in the league is allegedly shooting threes during this preseason. I have a hard time imagining Taj Gibson really becoming like a true stretch four. But the reason they're here is, like you said, Towns and Jimmy Butler are incredible, and I'm not willing to give up on them.
I mean, if I was Wiggins, I would probably request a trade. You know, like I probably would have done that. But I mean, first of all, I would have taken the money for sure. But I do think you're not going to be as frustrated at Wiggins this year as you were last year, because he's going to be asked to do a lot less. I think he's in the position where he's sacrificing a lot. You know, how much does he contribute to their wins and losses? You know, I'm not totally sure. I mean, I think it really comes down to Towns, Butler. The ball is probably going to be in Teague's hands a fair bit. But yeah, Wiggins to me looks kind of like the odd man out, which is tough because on the one hand, you want to be really excited about your max deal. On the other hand, you know, you have a shrinking role. How does a young player balance that? I don't know. Is he getting good advice? You know, looking at this agent saga, you know, it's hard to say that. So who knows? In terms of other teams, just real quickly, I'm actually pretty excited to watch this Cleveland experiment. Because I think it's going to get pretty dramatic. I think they can experiment a lot strategically. I am worried that, you know, Wade and Rose are going to factor too heavily into what's happening. But I also think LeBron is set up with the ultimate motivation of Kyrie leaving him. We always say, oh, LeBron's going to come out with a chip on his shoulder this year. I mean, we always come up with some excuse for why that should happen. Kyrie is more than just an excuse. Like, that is a legitimate slap in his face, Kyrie wanting to leave. And so I think that will be really fun to watch how he reacts.
Cavs-Celtics on opening night is going to be more entertaining. Like, there's going to be more justified hype in the build-up to that game than any basketball game until at least Christmas. So, like, the idea of motivated LeBron is completely real. And then beyond that, you're right. Like, they're another team that could roll out hockey shifts. J.R. Smith is coming off the bench as of today. Tyronn Lue announced it. It's going to be a strange mix. I thought most of the Seti Osman hype was, which I'm definitely saying that name wrong, but I thought it was a joke for most of the summer, but he's actually like shown some flashes for the Cavs, and I think he might be a legitimate factor. Like, I have no idea what to expect coming out of that rotation.
That was borderline guilty of your own preseason overreaction right there, I think. Maybe. Just maybe.
There's
just
been
a little touch.
That. There's been a lot of that. But look.
Just maybe.
Admit it, though. They might be more athletic and better than they were last year. That's not a crazy claim, is it?
Yeah. I think it really comes down to Wade and Rose, how well they hold up, if that claim is going to become true. But I think that if everybody's healthy, including Isaiah, it's possible.
Yeah.
You know, I think Isaiah is a crazy X factor for this whole season. I don't think we've really talked enough about Isaiah, honestly, because we don't know what to say. It's like, we have no idea when he's coming back. We have no idea if he's going to be 100% when he gets back. We have no idea how he's going to play with LeBron. How well LeBron's going to play with him, and then if he can stay on the court, if teams start really picking on him, you know, good teams like in the finals start picking on him. That's a lot of question marks. I think he's the biggest X factor in the entire league, and so from that standpoint, as soon as he comes back, I'm watching every Cavs game every night.
Yeah, well, it's also hard to have a real take on Isaiah because we're not, like, doctors, and we're not hip doctors, so it's tough to, like, really say. I mean, I think, like, looking at the way other guys have responded to the injuries he's had, I'm not super optimistic, and I don't think a lot of NBA teams are. But I mean, if even 80% of last year's Isaiah comes back, then they're going to be awesome and a lot of fun. And Kevin Love as small ball center will be great too.
For sure. And then one other team that we should shout out, I think the Spurs. I mean, when you have a superstar pairing like Kawhi Leonard and Patty Mills together, you know, two All-NBA candidates in Kawhi Leonard and Patty Mills, you know, guys that you just couldn't dribble the ball against.
I still cannot tell whether you were serious about Patty Mills, but that's a good way to close it. We're going to come back with teams to ignore at the beginning of Friday's podcast, and that'll be fun as well. But yes, I hope everyone enjoyed. Good luck to Joel Embiid. Come back soon, Isaiah Thomas. You know, we've hit a lot today.
We did. It was a surprisingly big news day. I don't know if we really shocked anyone with our picks. So I do think the real key takeaway from this season is follow the star power. You know, all these stars moved this summer. They have set up like five really intriguing teams. Don't overthink it. Watch how the stars fit in. See who clashes. See who really sails. And go from there.
And don't get tricked into caring about preseason basketball. We just need the real games to get here.
I never got to see Jeff Pendergraft's injury, and I'm not over it yet. All right, Andrew. Hey, by the way, 5-star reviews on iTunes, and I was playing around with the new Apple Podcast app. It is surprisingly easy to hand out a 5-star review. So there's no more excuses from you people. Get that Apple Podcast app up. Give us the 5-star review. Andrew, until later this week, I'll talk to you.
All right, man.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.